It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Historical marker for a Confederate general in downtown Salisbury has sparked petitions over whether it should be removed from county property. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. His name is General John Henry Winder, or Winder if you prefer. He was born in 1800 in Somerset County and the son of a U.S. Army brigadier general who fought in the War of 1812. After attending West Point, Winder joined the U.S. Army, and when the Civil War broke out in 1861, he joined the Confederate Army, eventually overseeing its prison of war camps. In 1965, the Maryland Centennial Commission put up a plaque for the general, which was eventually moved to the nearby courthouse in downtown Salisbury. But now there's a petition by a group called Showing Up for Racial Justice, led by James Yamakawa, calling for its removal. That sparked a counterpetition to keep the historical marker, led by Jonathan Taylor, who writes the Eastern Shore News blog. And this morning we have James by phone and Jonathan in studio, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Don.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So before actually we begin, let me just outline what the plaque says so everybody knows. It says, General John Henry Winder, CSA, born near Nanticoke. John Henry Winder was successively a graduate and instructor in West Point, a veteran of the Seminole and Mexican Wars. General Winder joined the Confederacy in 1861 and eventually directed all Confederate military prisons east of the Mississippi. And underneath it says Maryland Civil War Centennial Commission. So first of all, I want to turn to you, James, and give me your argument about why this particular plaque should be removed.
Okay, so a couple things. First, Winder was born in Nanticoke, which was then part of Somerset County. Wicomico County was not created until after the war and Winder's death. The marker was erected in the 1960s during the centennial of the Civil War and at the height of the civil rights movement. And the biggest thing, though, is it is a Confederate general's marker on the courthouse grounds, not 100 feet from where Matthew Williams was lynched in 1931, and equally as close to the former site of the Bird Tavern, where slaves were bought and sold in pre-Civil War days. So it's the image of having this marker commemorating a general who fought in the Confederacy for the cause of keeping black Americans enslaved next to the site where black American history has been forgotten and ignored. That'd be the main argument.
Jonathan, how do you respond?
Well, I completely disagree with that. I've had this conversation 1,000 times with people. That I don't see that monument as being anything more than just a monument letting people know that a guy from the area was a general in the Civil War. It says Confederate, but there's no Confederate flag on it. It's just a regular flag showing up on it. And to kind of read too much into it, that's on the individual person, not on everybody in general.
So I want to then turn to an interview I actually did with Mayor of Salisbury, Jake Day, who has called for removal of the historical marker. Now, he says he did so as a private citizen and suggests that the county and state will eventually have to decide if they will take action. And so we're going to go to that. And then after we come out of that, we're going to talk to Jonathan and get his reaction.
My position is based on this. Morally, I have a problem with its presence. It represents a guy who I don't think very much of. And look, he's General Winder served his country for a period of time, and then he served the CSA for a period of time. I imagine there are good things that he did in his life, but I'm very aware of the bad things that he did in his life.
The prison stuff.
Yeah, so let's not forget that it's not as if this was, a general who led troops into battle and fought valiantly and passed away, and that's all she wrote. What in fact happened is, this is a man who was born in Nanticoke at the age of 2, was moved by his father to Baltimore, lived in Baltimore, then moved to North Carolina, then went to West Point, became an officer in the Army, then defected and became an officer, fighting for the Confederate States of America. And as an officer there, he rose through the ranks, became a general, was given command of the prison system where he was accused of and not found guilty of because he had a heart attack the year that he was supposed to go to trial, but was accused of torturing and murdering U.S. soldiers. And I imagine most of your listeners know that I wear the uniform of the United States Army. And I give no quarter to traitors. And anybody who killed U.S. soldiers by torturing them, not in the heat of battle, not in defending a position, but tortured people who were under his control and under his command, who he was supposed to take care of. This violates everything that's true and decent about represents any soldier, regardless of what uniform they wear, or any person in the military. What violates anything that I think is decent as a human being, and we've got a sign for the guy in Salisbury. So, you know, he has no connection to Salisbury, no connection to downtown Salisbury, no connection to that piece of property. And yet there are some significant historical Civil War era events that took place here. We have nothing that acknowledges Camp Upton. We have nothing that in a significant way. We don't do a good job of acknowledging the history that is connected to Salisbury and even that location, which, by the way, is a location where the second to last lynching in Maryland's history took place. And I think that's relevant to these conversations. So with all that, why in the world is this sign here? If Nanticoke is proud of the guy, Nanticoke can have the sign. If Nanticoke's not proud of the guy, then, and I would understand why, then, you know, put it in a museum or something. You know, I also think it's a bit disingenuous to suggest that this is an erasure of history. It's not accurate. It doesn't talk about the guy's history. It doesn't talk about what he did or what he's accused of. It doesn't talk about the evidence that supports it. It doesn't talk about any of that. It's a relatively benign marker in terms of its content. It's vanilla. I would just say that if we concern ourselves at all with history, then the marker is poorly located.
Why do you think that there's resistance to the idea of, say, removing this kind of plaque?
Okay. I'm going to tell you. I'm going to give you two reasons. One, I believe that most people who are disconcerted with the idea of moving it, most of that is probably about ignorance. Ignorance to the fact that General Winder isn't from Salisbury, doesn't have a connection here. They probably also don't know the history of General Winder and what he did. But I cannot fail to draw a connection between the fact that the very same people who say history is important, we need to keep that sign there, are the very same people who are opposed to anything that acknowledges the second to last lynching in Maryland of Matthew Williams on that property, on a tree that still exists on that property. That, to me, is just an undeniable connection. And it begs the question, why is one okay and why is one not? I don't want to speculate as to why. I would say that there are probably a variety of reasons that are rooted in history and that are rooted in deep emotions and maybe in family lineages, but I have a real problem that those two things seem to align so easily.
So do you think there's this underlying racial quality then to this?
Absolutely there is. Absolutely yeah. There is.
And that's Mayor Jake Day, and he, of course, supports the removal of the historical marker. He does so as a private citizen. By the way, I should note that in talking to Jonathan earlier, he has no problems, as he indicated to me, to having some marker for Matthew Williams, who, of course, was lynched here in the 1930s. And I want you to pick up on what the mayor said. And one of the questions that arises from his description of the general himself is, maybe this is the wrong guy. We're not talking about a General Lee. We're not talking about, you know, Stonewall Jackson. We're talking about somebody who was involved with the prisons and who was certainly accused of what wouldn't certainly be today war crimes.
Well, I understand, and Jake is a good guy. I like Jake, but me and him are like completely opposite ends of the spectrum on this. We've had this conversation between us like seems like 1,000 times. My great 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 grandfather was a prisoner of war in Libby Prison in the Civil War, and it was a prison that was being supervised by Winder, and you know, he was a prisoner exchange. I think what we miss is that this was the Civil War, where how the North won the war was cutting off supplies to the southern states. That's how they won the war. So when the supplies are low, the Confederates couldn't even feed their own troops that were out on the front lines fighting, let alone be able to feed the way. And I'm not saying it's correct, but they couldn't have the food and supplies to take care of prisoners. But, I mean, there was also that happened on the northern end as well. It's just kind of like a big, broad spectrum of, you know, painting it in one particular way. And as far as, like, I understand what, you know, some people want to look at it as a race issue, but I just don't, I don't see it as that. I only see it as that if you want to see it as that. And I guess they could look at me and say, well, you're just not seeing it because you don't want to. No, I just don't see it, period. I mean, I just don't. I don't look at it and go, oh, this is celebrating racism. I don't. I just like it's a guy from the area. I mean, even though he left it too, it don't matter. He was born here. And Wicomico County didn't even exist until 1867. So if that was the case, we would say nobody was from Wicomico County. If we're going to be putting that out there that somehow nobody before that counts as a citizen. And the courthouse is the main place for Wicomico County. So, I mean, if you're going to celebrate somebody from the area, whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, that would be the location to put it.
James, what about that?
Well, I have two quotes that are going to connect to this here. The first is by a author, black author, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Racism is not merely a simplistic hatred. It is more often broad sympathy towards some and broad skepticism towards others. Now, the monument to General Winder, and it's a historical marker, it's a very simple plaque, but it still says something about what our community values. It says, we value this. We value this man's history, as disconnected as it may be from the area. Like as Jake Day wonderfully explained, much better than I ever could, that this man was not connected to the area as much as we think he might have been. So the basically having that marker says that we value that history and not the history of other things surrounding the courthouse. As to the cause of the Confederacy, it's you can't separate racism from the Civil War. You can't separate racism from anything in this country, honestly, in my opinion. For example, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander H. Stephens, in a speech he gave not 3 weeks before the start of the Civil War when the South fired on Fort Sumter, he said, "Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rest, upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition." And this wasn't an uncommon idea in the Confederate states. A handful of states, like Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, like, you know, Texas, they had statements within their declarations of secession that says slavery was the main cause, like the main reason why they seceded from the Union. So you can't separate slavery, you can't separate white supremacy and racism from any discussion about the Civil War. So having this marker next to a place where slaves were bought and sold, and next to a place where years later a black man was lynched for the crime of being black, that itself says that our community values the history of this Confederate general more than the black history. The black history, which is our history, which is American history, that surrounds that courthouse.
Jonathan, how do you separate out the racial component of the Civil War on the one hand, as opposed to how many people certainly in the South may view it? Because if you look at, for instance, the racial legacy of slavery, once slavery ends, that doesn't mean that the racial component ends, right? Because we have obviously had Jim Crow. And yeah, even after when Jim Crow was legally demolished, they still had to have things like affirmative action in order to deal with that relationship, which lives on even often to this day. Yeah. How do you separate the two? And I mean, because on the one hand, you want to honor the people who fought. On the other hand, there is this cause. I mean, it seems to me it creates a conundrum, as it were.
Well, I think it's also a history lesson in and of itself, because, you know, you take that the Civil War, you know, there was the fighting and did involve slavery. But it also is, it's such a bigger scale of also not wanting, like in our last election, people didn't want New York and L.A. deciding, you know, an election by population centers. And the South looked at it as the North telling them what they should be doing, which was a big cause. And not every soldier was fighting for slaves. A lot of them were states' rights people, which is, you know, a patriotic thing now to look at. But back then it was, it was different. And I understand that people would look at it as, you know, the slavery thing, and that's absolutely horrible. And I don't think you'll find anybody that would sit here today and say, oh, slavery was good. Nobody's going to say that. I think what happened was you had groups like the Klan that took over that symbolism of the Confederacy to make their own hatred. And then people want to associate the Klan and the Confederate flag as just complete racism instead of just sticking to the Civil War, which was the difference between states back in the 1850s and 60s. That's my view of it.
Okay. Now, although I would just make this observation that when people talk about states' rights, that's a means to an end. That is, you use rights. So for my I often said that if, for instance, the preserve slavery, you could preserve it with a central government, strong central government, you might do that. But let me ask you this. So how does one deal with this idea that, you know, one could say all these artifacts are from about 150 years or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that these artifacts have also been used for instance, in the opposition to Jim Crow, in favor of Jim Crow. So, for example, we saw a lot of Confederate flags go up above the state capitals during the opposition to desegregation. So even to this day, these symbols are connected to that particular issue of race. I'm reminded of somebody who was a state legislator in South Carolina after the shootings there, the 9 African-Americans. One of the state legislators was an African-American who was killed. And the white legislator said that he never realized what that flag meant until this happened to his friend. I mean, so there is something more going on here than just you're trying to separate it out.
Yeah, well, I think part of the problem also is when you see, like, the guy that went into church and shot, you know, the black people in the church. What I don't like is people seeing this guy had Confederate flags and this guy had this kind of thing, and that must mean that that's what drove him to be an idiot and go in and kill people. I'm like, well, you know, some people like the Confederate flag just because it symbolizes the South. I understand that the Klan and others used it as a way to be, you know, a racist organization, and they're as much to blame for the problem as anybody else. Nobody has any tolerance for them as well as, you know, the groups like James runs that I think are the other way, you know, forcing racism every single day on people that don't even think about it and kind of forced issue on everybody to talk about it. And I just don't see it as much as people want to say that it's out there, because I think people are much more civilized these days and it's not something that's in the forefront of everybody's mind.
James, what about this idea about trying to address people who look at the Confederate flag or can look at Confederate symbols and they don't see in themselves their identity to either slavery or to racism, that they simply see this as a symbol of heritage? Well, of course, obviously, many African Americans are going to see it in a much different light. How do you bridge that gap?
The way I see this is very much trying to put yourself into the experience of another person. It's a Christian belief of mine that we have to do unto others as we would have done unto ourselves. The idea that it doesn't mean that the Confederate flag and other symbols of the Confederacy, by the way, the KKK was started by Confederate veterans originally. The fact that the Confederate symbols don't mean the same thing to a large segment of white Americans does not mean that the symbols don't mean something completely different to another section. We have to be willing to hear our black brothers and sisters, our fellow citizens, when they say that this symbol means something very, very different to them. It reminds them of slavery. It reminds them of Jim Crow, segregation, of separate but equal, of the violence that has been done to black America. And it's not on them to prove to us that that is true. It is on us. It's on white Americans like Mr. Taylor and myself to hear that and to take them at their word. Whether it means something to the individual who has their Confederate flag in their bedroom because they like the idea of Southern pride. That means something, but it doesn't negate the fact that it means something vastly different to a whole bunch of other people.
Jonathan, what do you make of the fact that we've seen this shift now that seems to occur in terms of federal monuments, particularly obviously after the shooting in South Carolina? That prior to that shooting, the statues were up. There was very little discussion. I can remember at least one presidential primary in which in 1990s, in which the great debate was about whether or not the flag should indeed be flown over the state capitol in South Carolina. And the presidential candidate said that should be left to the states. It was an issue that they didn't want to touch. Now it seems as if there is this movement, even amongst conservatives, people like Nikki Haley and so on, many of the Republicans, they're shifting away from that. And there's obviously a lot of turmoil now going on in terms of removing statues, removing flags. I mean, it's on and on it goes. What do you make of that shift?
I'm actually sorry to see it. Because to me, those symbols are just symbolizing our American history. People don't like it. I understand that, but it happened. And I don't see a symbol of Robert E. Lee that they're talking about in, Virginia as some big thing that should be a big issue where people ride by it every day and going, oh, they're saying racism's good because there's a Robert E. Lee statue. It doesn't equate to that, to normal people that don't see race every single day like that. And like I said, James with his SURJ group that's affiliated with Black Lives Matter, they're just as bad as any other group out there to me as a hate group that they just want to stir up racial animosity.
You don't think that they're speaking to racial injustice, whether it's Black Lives Matter? Why not?
Because I think that their whole purpose is to just stir things up with bringing up race and everything, even if it's not there. It's always bringing up race to somebody that, coming in there for the monuments or something else like having a rally for the guy that was lynched. But I said, where were they last year, 3 years ago, 4 years ago? It's just because right now it's a hot button topic. Everybody wants to come out of the woodwork to get their 5 or 10 minutes on the air or TV so that they can talk about it and look like they're like a race warrior or something. And honestly, that causes more racism than it would if you just left it alone and didn't talk about it, because people are going to respond to it.
James, why don't you respond?
I probably should have saved the Ta-Nehisi Coates quotes to now. I'm going to read it again simply because it says better than I ever could. Racism is not merely a simplistic hatred. It is more often broad sympathy towards some and broad skepticism towards others. And what Mr. Taylor is showing is that his sympathy lies towards people that he feels comfortable with, and that is, white America, which is, he has a right to believe what he believes. But it's that skepticism toward anything that challenges that worldview. It's not, and he tries to connect our group to the Black Lives Matter movement, which as some kind of pejorative. I think it would be honored to be considered part of the Black Lives Matter movement, because Black Lives Matter, all that they're trying to say is that Black lives have historically not mattered in our country. And that sympathy towards white America, but that skepticism toward the experiences of Black America is the problem. And saying that racism wouldn't exist if we just ignored racism is part of that skepticism towards the experiences of people who are not white.
Jonathan, I want you to respond, but one of the things that strikes me is that folks, I'm white, and all the people in this discussion are white.
No, you're not, Don. No.
Anyway, one of the things that strikes me, though, is that for the white community, racial incidents on a daily basis are not necessarily visible to us. We don't see them, whether it's somebody's followed around in a store, for example. Mm-hmm. So that there may be a lack of awareness within the white community about this issue. And when it's brought to the fore, we are quite surprised, or we say, no, this is something that maybe is perhaps stirring something up because we're not aware of it. What about the fact that we on this side of the line, as it were, that we're not really necessarily aware, and maybe we should be.
I think it's a generational thing because, like, when I was, I mean, I'm not that old, but I can understand if you were like 70, 80 years old and you grew up through, you know, the civil rights movement and it was a problem back then. But like in today's age, I mean, everybody's pretty much on the same level with each other. And so, and I think a lot of times when, you know, like people that want to talk like lately, the term the white privilege, like somehow that because I'm born white means that I walk around like I'm more arrogant or something. That kind of stuff just makes people feel like you're calling me a racist because I was born white. Like, you know, I don't feel that way. And what happens is you keep pushing people by saying you're racist because you're white. Well, you're going to make people feel hatred towards whoever's saying it, whether that's the SURJ people, black people, or whoever. And I think you just kind of make it happen by creating that kind of environment with people.
James, I'm just going to respond to that. And how do you deal with what someone might say? Well, I resent the idea that someone is saying or implying, for instance, that I'm racist in the white community. How do you deal with that?
I guess the first thing I would say is that it's not about you. It's part of that, like, you know, white privilege that Mr. Taylor was talking about is not having to deal with the fact of our whiteness, without having to deal with the fact that, yes, just because I'm white does not mean I'm a bad person. That's obvious. No one's saying that. No, people are saying is that white people have historically had advantages in this country, designed advantages in this country, because of their association with whiteness. So saying that, that, like, you know, like you feel bad because people are calling you racist, that's besides the point. It's not about you. It's about the people who are being harmed by that. And it's a privilege to say that, like, you know, I don't like what you're saying, so I'm going to dismiss it.
Jonathan, just following up, do you have a sense that you indicated almost a moment ago that we're all on the equal footing? I can imagine I've talked to a number of African Americans who say that's clearly not the case. We've seen some studies. If you send a resume in and your name looks African American, you're less likely to be called back. So there's still that there, and I think that's what's indicated by white privilege, I guess, is a way.
I think there's a lot of people that feel nowadays like being black is the privilege that gets them up to the top of the list, because there is a lot of people to feel like now that it's gone overboard, where it's like, oh, well, if there's 5 white applicants and 1 black applicant, that even if the white people aren't qualified or, you know, like are qualified, that they're going to go with the black person because they feel like that's the best way to go and, you know, make people feel comfortable because, hey, we hired the black guy and not the white. And people see that, and it makes people feel like, well, I understand that it was unfair back in, you know, the 1960s, but this is 2017. And, you know, a lot of younger people, you know, are like, what's up with that? I mean, I didn't do anything. I didn't own any slaves or anything, but they see it as an unequal kind of playing field now.
Right. Even though when we do surveys and studies, we find that there's still an advantage if you're a white applicant, for example, right?
Yeah, I mean,
is it more a feeling, you think, than?
I think that there's a lot of people out there that do feel that more is given towards the black community just because they feel like it's like a we owe it to them kind of thing. And I'm not saying we don't owe, you know, for the what happened in the past, but you can't expect the modern times to pay for what happened 100 years ago or 40 years ago, 50 years ago. It had nothing to do with me. It was terrible, but at the same time, I don't want to spend the rest of my life answering questions about being racist because of something happened in 1950 South Carolina or something. You know, that's my view.
James, final thoughts?
I think, again, just bringing it back to the subject of the marker. The marker is honoring a Confederate general who fought for the cause of keeping black people enslaved next to a courthouse where slaves were bought and sold, next to a courthouse where a black man was lynched by hundreds of white Salisbury residents for the crime of being black. White feelings do not matter more than black lives, than any lives. But in this case, we're talking about black lives.
We've been speaking with James Yamakawa. He's with Showing Up for Racial Justice, and also Jonathan Taylor, who writes the Eastern Shore News blog. Appreciate both of you coming in and having a good discussion about this. And no doubt we'll see how the issue unfolds, particularly in terms of the plaque. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Chris Heim, inviting you to join me in the Global Village for the best in music from around the globe. Each week, we journey around the world for the most compelling new releases, rare and classic recordings, birthday spotlights, and other features and specials, along with a surprising array of artists from almost every style imaginable who incorporate international sounds into their work. That's all in the Global Village, Saturdays at 4, here on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Hi, this is Steve Martin, the host of Unreal Bluegrass. Each week we'll bring you a wide range of bluegrass from the innovative artists of today to the traditional pickers from yesteryear. All this and interviews with players from all walks of life. That's 3 hours of Unreal Bluegrass every Sunday at 7 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.
In our world, ideas can be liturgy. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, generous conversation about the questions that matter most. What does it mean to be human? And how do we want to live? We explore with theologians, scientists, philosophers, thinkers, and activists every week from American Public Media.
Sunday mornings at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7.
Hope you can join us this Saturday at 8 for 2 hours of great country music. We're going to have some fun with numbers, and we're going to feature some birthdays for Jeannie Seely and Charlie Louvin and Doyle Wilburn. And at the top of the second hour, we're going to feature the top 10 for the year 1948 here on WSDL.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. I believe the more we know and understand about our world, the more fun it is to explore. We're all in the same traveler's school of hard knocks, and it's okay to share notes. Let's spend an hour together each week exploring the places and people that make our world so inviting. And we can share tips that help turn our travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality.
Saturday mornings at 7 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
It's been described as a whodunit, and it has once again embroiled the Waccamaw County Executive in a battle with his fellow Republicans on the county council. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Began with a November 19th, 2015 letter purportedly written by then Finance Director Leslie Lewis, addressed to County Executive Bob Culver, found by the county auditor. It recommended a raise, apparently for the head of the Human Resources Department, Michelle Ennis. Lewis says she has no knowledge of the letter. Certified fraud examiner James Kern was brought in by the county council, but after initial effort to question employees, county Executive Bob Culver refused further cooperation. Council President John Cannon then found himself and his fellow council members on the receiving end of denunciations by Culver, who called the audit a witch hunt. And, of course, the audit eventually ended. Also, to take even more turmoil into the issue, Culver also fired the finance director in May. To sort this strange odyssey out, we have Greg Bassett. He's the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent. I must say, this sounds more like something coming out of Washington than it does out of Waccamaw County. Where do we start in terms of this conflict? I mean, this strange letter, which is like a few years ago, then suddenly kind of emerges, and everybody's looking at it as if it's a great document. Give us some background.
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of personality conflicts that are going on here, a lot of dynamics, a lot of people with some egos. But this all goes back to an auditor's report in 2015, where auditors come in and they'll have a checklist of things that they want to look at. So they'll have employees bring them various files. And one of the things that was on the checklist was a review of the file of the HR director for the county, Michelle Ennis. In that file, they found a letter that approved her raise, that recommended her raise. And the letter looked suspicious to them. It wasn't written on county letterhead. Leslie Lewis's name did not use the middle initial that she always, she's Leslie Martin Lewis, and she was very rigid about everyone using the M. So that is not there. The letter's not signed, but it's got the her name and the name of an employee in the county who I still don't know, someone who is not high enough in county government that I could use them as a public source. So under the personnel rules, I do have to sort of protect their name, but I don't know the name. But it's someone who either works in the finance office or the HR office somewhere in the county who is not part of the big picture. So anyway, the auditors started asking questions about this letter. They went to Lewis since her name was on it. And Lewis was like, I didn't write that letter. I don't know what it is.
So at this point, they decide to hire an outside auditor or an outside the fraud examiner. So what does he find? And what was his experience like in terms of dealing with the county executive?
Well, there are two things that happen. First is that the auditors do go ahead and close the books on 2015, the fiscal year 16, and declare that everything's in order. They don't have any big problems. But they did refer this letter to the county council's internal auditor, Steve Roser. Now, the internal auditor is someone who works for the legislative branch for the council, and the idea there is that he is free to see what the executive branch of the government is doing without interference. So it was referred to him initially, and then he took it to the county council, and they were like, we don't know what to make of this thing. We don't know if it's big or not. Among themselves, they couldn't decide how serious it was. At first, they were like, oh, my, yeah, this is serious. And then as time went on and they thought about it more, they couldn't decide how important it was. So they hired the forensic auditor who came in and did the investigation.
And so what did he find? What was his experience like with the county executive?
Well, you can argue he did everything wrong. But that's how these auditor guys are. They're not friendly, fun guys. They come in and they raise an air of suspicion and they drill on you. So he arrived last fall at the county government building, and he asked to talk first to the woman whose name is on the letter, other than Leslie Lewis. And as I said, she's not a higher echelon person. She was felt very intimidated by the auditor. She admitted immediately that she wrote the letter, and she said she couldn't speak anymore unless her supervisor was there. So her supervisor arrives, and the county executive arrives with him, or her. I'm not sure if it's a him or her. And now I think about it, it must have been her. But anyway, county executive arrives. He's like, what are you doing? Auditor explains his purpose. County executive, blindsided by this, was pretty offended. They had a tense interaction, and the auditor was invited to leave, that no more county employees were going to speak to him that day.
So, by the way, just let me get clear. So the individual that he talked to, the auditor talked to, that individual said that they did write the letter.
Yes.
Okay. That has not only the employee's name on, but also Michelle Ennis's name on.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It was the raise letter that went into Michelle's file.
Okay. So so then you get this response by the county council of deciding ultimately to end the investigation, even though they spent a few thousand dollars.
Well, there's back and forth about whether the county executive was going to let people be interviewed by the auditor. In the end, the county executive, once he knew who wrote the letter and what the circumstances of the letter were, to him, there was no need for the investigation to continue. There was nothing left to find out. The council wasn't so sure, though. They wanted to know on their own. And the auditor was frustrated because he wasn't able to deliver a complete report. Not all the stones were unturned. He did not know exactly what happened. There's a conjecture, but he doesn't really know. So he wanted to continue interviewing the county attorney, County Attorney Paul Weber got involved. They agreed that employees could be interviewed with an attorney present if the stuff was recorded. That all fell apart. That never happened. So the auditor, in his report to the county council, said that he could not determine what had happened. And that audit cost $19,700.
Okay. So then you get a response from the county executive, Bob Culver, who, as a matter of fact, denounced the audit as legally reckless, a fruitless witch hunt, dishonorable and appalling. And then he emerges with his own emails. It all sounds very familiar.
Right.
So what did you make of the emails and what Culver said they represented? Because as I was reading John Cannon's response, Cannon seemed to indicate that it was all just still too vague.
Yeah, and that's the county council's pretty unanimous on it being all too vague. They still don't know what happened. When they're out at the Lions Club or the fire meetings and people say, what happened? They don't really know what happened. And it frustrates them, certainly, with an election coming up, not knowing what happened. But also the auditor, James Kern, who has 35 years experience, he presented his report first to the county council, and we were all shocked that his report went into the briefing book for the July 5th meeting of the county council with all the names redacted. And it was quickly, easily able, reporters were able to figure out who everyone was, even with the redacted names. So that didn't really protect the people's names, right, and what was going on. He makes this report to the county council. There was even tension about that. Councilman John Hall, at the urging of the county attorney Paul Wilbur, had asked that all that be done in closed session. They decided to accept the audit in open session. Only one question was asked. Holloway asked whether Joe Holloway asked if, you know, the auditor, if people are normally uncooperative in these things. And he said no. It was like the first time ever that someone hadn't cooperated in this about the county executive. So they just sort of left it in the air. They accepted the audit. Then they released a statement saying, we don't know what really happened here. Then the next day, the county executive, Bob Culver, called a news conference. He read a statement of all of 1 minute. He was very upset. You could tell. He was angry. He was frustrated. He declined to take questions, but then he went out in the hallway and he did take some questions, but he blasted him with both barrels. The idea that, yes, it cost $20,000 on their end for the audit, but the time spent by his employees and by the county attorney was going to add to that expense. He felt like it was a witch hunt. He felt like they were opportunists, that something was going on, and the county council wanted to exploit that. But most of all, and the key to this thing is, he said that we do this all the time. So someone will create a letter that goes into the file that backs up the electronic form that they fill out that actually makes it all official. And maybe they're not so careful with that paperwork, so it looks kind of sloppy. On that raised letter, the employee, Michelle Ennis, I think had been advocating for a higher raise. The first letter was written for a 12% raise for her. The county executive wrote on that letter, and it's his handwriting. The auditor wasn't sure at first if it was his handwriting or not. They were suspicious of that, because it didn't look like his previous handwriting. But he says he wrote all over it. He reduced the raise from 12% to 8%. So he had seen the letter. But his point was, we write letters like this all the time.
Now, the emails that they refer to, so do they back up this idea that I mean, I think at one point I thought that it said that there was a different version of the letter in the emails. Is that right?
That's where I'm still confused, and I have more reporting to do. The county executive released a copy of the letter that was unredacted, but it's a different version of the letter. So it's the letter with the underling employee's name removed and only signed by Leslie Lewis, purportedly signed by Leslie Lewis, seemingly signed by Leslie Lewis, who has maintained that she never signed the letter or saw the letter. In the email string, which I don't know how conclusive it is because it's really kind of muddled, there's a conversation where they're going to go meet the county executive to talk about some stuff. I don't think it's exactly this raise. I guess it was this raise and other things. And Leslie was told to bring the letter with her, you know, bring the letter along so we can look at the letter. So that would make it seem like she knew about the letter, but it's hardly conclusive.
Hmm. So what is it? I mean, we get this fiery reaction by the county executive, but I'm reminded that this is not the first dispute that this county executive has had with the council, and he talks about people having political agendas. What's beyond, if we step back from just the scandal or whatever you want to call it, what else is going on here? Because it sounds like there's some other dynamics that are happening simultaneously.
Yeah, they're all flexing their muscles, and the county executive, again, at the end of this thing, said, I just wish they had come to me. If they had just come to me in the beginning, I could have explained what happened and none of this would have been necessary. The council's attitude is he would have talked his way out of it. We needed to do our job and keep him accountable. That's what the branches of government do. So that's their attitude. But he's the county executive. He wants to run things. He wants the council to follow him. And they don't always follow him. So in the budget, it was the same thing. There was a problem in the budget. The council cut taxes. Surprisingly, shockingly, they had not done anything to indicate they were going to cut taxes. They cut taxes. They used the cuts. And they also added some funding to the school board for some school board programs that people had wanted in public hearings. And it was just a shocking list that they had turned in. Well, they weren't, because they were not involving the executive in what was going on, they didn't follow the rules exactly right in terms of the budget. So they ended up with a budget that was not balanced and had things miscategorized. So there was a back and forth about that. They only wanted to make right what they had done. The county executive wanted to open things up and renegotiate some other things in the budget. Because instead of spending the money on education, he wanted to spend some money on public safety. There was a back and forth about that. And they refused to engage him. So when they first cut taxes, his attitude, what he said over and over again, is if they had just come to me, you know, we could have worked this out together and there wouldn't have been the mistakes made, which almost made the budget late. But it was all taken care of in time.
Are there any political ambitions by any of these council members that would make some, have some impact on whether or not on his own future prospects, that is Culver's future prospects? I mean, is there anything in the wind here as to why? Because, I mean, he seemed to implicate that there's more going on than just simply the traditional give and take between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
Yeah, the consensus would be that the county council president, John Cannon, will run for county executive. Now, he's never said that he'll run. He's actually made moves contrary to perhaps running. There was talk that Senator Addie Eckert might retire from the state Senate. John moved his house from Nutter's Crossing in East Salisbury out to the west side, so he's in District 37. So potentially he could run for a seat out there. There's talk of that. He hasn't really shown to me that with his own business and everything he has going on that he really wants to spend the time to be county executive. He's obviously torqued at Bob Culver. It's obvious that they do not get along, which is fascinating to me because they grew up together in Salisbury. They've known each other their entire lives. John was from a sort of wealthy family, a power family. His father was a delegate and major property owner in town, very influential. Culver's from the other side of the tracks. He had to work a lot harder in his mind. So there's a very interesting dynamic that goes on there. But beyond John Cannon, I can't find anyone who really wants to run. There's no Democrat that I can find who wants to run. And there's some Republicans who don't really meet the threshold, I would say, to be like, you know, real like scary candidates at this point in a primary. Ironically, the primary is only 11 months away. And I say only 11 months. It sounds like a long time, but it's not in terms of politics. And the other thing that's going on there is when you've got the 7 school board races, the 7 county council races, you got the courthouse seats, the judges are running, and all the legislators are running. It's about 24 open positions, 24 seats that are in play. Can we find 24 people to run for offices in Wicomico County? That's a lot.
By the way, how do you compare the relationship that, say, Bob Culver has to, say, somebody like Rick Pollitt? And obviously, Pollitt was on the other side of the party aisle. He was a Democrat, as opposed to most of the Republicans on the county council. What difference in style did?
Yeah, Pollitt was everyone wanted to get along with everyone. He was a go along to get along. He was probably the quintessential good old boy. You know, really connected to the county, knew everyone, very friendly, very affable. But he and Bob Culver fought. Bob was a council member and fought the executive a lot, joined by Stevie Prettyman. So they were sort of a tandem together, really beating on Rick, you know, his entire 8 years. So it's ironic that when Culver now is county executive, when the council wants to beat on him, you know, it upsets him.
So, I mean, at this point, because early on, I mean, I remember there was an issue about the West Salisbury school.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, he came out with this thing, you know, and then Cannon and folks said, hey, you know, we've already decided, we've been through this. I mean, there seems to be, from his side of the aisles, it does seem as if he will go out and decide to do things or announce things or take positions without consulting the council people on the other hand. I mean, there seems to be, I mean, and that's what struck me initially when he came into office, is that all of a sudden you had these sudden disputes, and you wouldn't think there would be.
Well, there's a couple of ironies there. The first meeting after he was elected, the first time they all got together that I saw was at a Chamber of Commerce forum. And Bob spoke first, and he said that he wanted to treat, even though he'd had problems with the executive as a council member, he wanted to treat the council as his cabinet, that they all had their expertise in different issues. So he would call on Matt Holloway for farming issues. He would call on John Cannon for small business issues. He would call on John Hall for advice about the airport, because John Hall has been the airport liaison for so long. The looks on their faces was that wasn't what they had signed up for exactly, but it's only the first day of school, so they're gonna get through this and figure out what's going to happen. But then that went off the rails very fast because he did try to change some things right away. And one was the West Salisbury construction project, and the other was phase three of the Bennett project. Now, I have to give Bob credit or understanding. He was saying what people had told him, that the people who got him elected, what they said. We don't need to spend all this money on West Salisbury School. Most people don't even know where West Salisbury Elementary is because it's out in a place that most people don't get to. It's not on the way to anything, if that makes sense. And same thing with Bennett. Like, what do we need all this money for these athletic fields for Bennett? There are people who you could argue just don't get it, but they were the voices that were in his head when he got elected. So he wanted to do things in a better way so he could tell everyone, hey, I tried, you know, and maybe made some success, maybe he didn't. But both of those projects were out of the barn. They were too far along in the process for him to change. But I do admire that he stuck up for it. I mean, he went to Bennett, met with like 300 high school kids and tried to explain his plan. They shut him down. They were like, no, this is, you know, we're going to get these fields. And it was very interesting to watch. And I think he learned from that. I do. But he tried to go out and do what his constituency asked him to do or wanted him to do.
So you think he's changed then over the years? Or
you're talking about him and Pilot, yeah. The difference. He's much more hands-on than Pilot. I mean, Bob is there every day. He's working. He's involved in everything that goes on. He's with Wayne Strasberg, who is a holdover from the Pilot administration, works very closely with Wayne. He's very connected to county employees. You know, he's there all the time. Rick was sort of a different school. Rick was there all the time, was there a lot, but he wasn't as involved. He let the staff do more of the work. You could say that he like drove around and cut ribbons and sort of was the ambassador for the county, more so than Bob. But Bob Culver is in there with his sleeves rolled up every day working.
Now, one of the things that also struck me is that that Culver and the county were much more amenable to trying to figure out with the city about services and about the duplicate services. But then you have this sort of breakaway fire department, this volunteer fire company, and he seems to have gotten himself into a fix with that as well.
Yes. So I can understand his point of view, too. He's got a problem out at the airport. Piedmont's going to stop maintaining the fire service out there, which they've done forever. Someone's got to do it. It's in the Parsonsburg district. But under the rules, you have to be at a burning plane within 3 minutes. So you have to have people staffed at the airport. The county's going to have to hire someone to go out there and staff it. Bob doesn't want to do that. So he thought, well, wait, we've got these renegade fire people from Company One in Salisbury. They're looking for something to do. Let's put them out at the airport. Apparently, they're interested in the airport, but they're not that interested in the airport. They're interested in having their own district on the east side with their own firehouse on Snow Hill Road. So that conflict is in play. Plus, you've got the fire services agreement, which doesn't allow for this, that's in play. So now you have another situation where you've got John Cannon representing one point of view on this. Jake Day, our very powerful mayor, representing another point of view, and then Bob. So there's letters going back and forth. There's a lot of tension about this. The firefighters are involved, so that always makes it an emotional issue. It's a public safety issue, so it is important. But this thing is going to play out for a long time.
Why do you think that Cannon is reluctant to say, you know, to provide funding and or anything like that for these firefighters? Because my understanding, and particularly in local politics, volunteer fire companies have a certain political clout. And it would seem as if Cannon's saying, well, we're gonna put this group off. I mean, what's going on there?
I think if you watch in the meetings with the rebel firefighters when they talk, it's hard to put a lot of trust into them. You have to wonder if they really have their act together or not. Now, the mayor certainly has made it seem like that they don't, you know, that they're not wanted. And, you know, good luck to you, but, you know, you have no value to us. That's probably tainted them to a degree. They've also been pretty aggressive about what they want to do without really any belief that they can succeed at that. But the other problem that's going on here is that there's actually a very strong movement toward paid fire companies everywhere. So volunteers are sort of showing that they can't always get the job done. My grandfather was the fire chief in Ocean City, so for me to say this is sacrilege. But there's a feeling that the paid people have to be there to get anywhere within 3 minutes, that volunteers can't necessarily do that. So there's going to have to be a paid equivalent out there somehow at the airport.
So this dispute with this particular company, and this reaches back. I mean, I remember they were going around about this when I first got here in 2003, 2004.
That was station two, though. That was a different station.
What is it? I mean, but it seems like there were like these similar issues about reporting and so on. I mean, is it just simply the times have changed in terms of what the city is doing? Or, I mean, the city seemed to be take a hard line even then with Station 2.
Well, Salisbury was always the only one with a paid fire staff, and that was only because the town burned down twice. So that's why Salisbury for a century has had paid staff. But it's these guys who were involved in firefighting volunteers, it's all they care about. I mean, they're really into this. So they're big proponents of themselves. They're proponents of their equipment. They spend a lot of money. I mean, there was the suit here where the volunteers who were kicked out of Station 1 in Salisbury, they wanted their equipment back. They valued the stuff that they had bought for the city to help the fire thing at over $700,000. A judge didn't necessarily agree that there was that much stuff, but you can see that they really were investing in their volunteers and investing in the city. So they're very committed to this. And anything that messes with that commitment is always unnerving. When you have a paid fire chief telling them what to do, the chiefs historically would maybe give preference to the paid guys and let the volunteer guys do the grunt work. And that's not how it was historically. They had their own volunteer chief who gave them orders. The paid chief gave the paid guys orders. And the people at the top sort of worked it out. But now there's one unified chief in Salisbury. And the volunteers report to that chief as well.
Now, in fact, in all of this, Mayor Jake Day seemed like he just, you know, he went out there and it was this sort of this, you know, I don't really care kind of attitude. And I'm going to stand up to these people, I guess, is the impression I got. Was that because he felt strongly about it? Or was that because, in addition to perhaps that there was a strong support for him taking such a strong stand?
He was presented with statistical information that the volunteers were not getting to the site in time, getting to the station in time to report. And it was a consistent problem. There was a training problem. And he just declared that they weren't going to tolerate anymore. They were going to get rid of the people who could not get there in time. Now, I remember when I was a kid, you didn't always go to the fire station if you're a volunteer. You go to the scene, you know. But all that's changed. Things have changed in terms of their procedures. And sometimes the volunteers wouldn't even go to the scene. They would just go to the firehouse, the station, and man the station in case something happened while the paid guys were out in the field.
Hmm. We've been speaking with Greg Bassett. He's the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent. And by the way, if you want to know more about the whole email letter controversy, a great piece on the Salisbury Independent.
Yeah, we have it from the beginning to end. So I think I've answered pretty much every question I've been asked about it. It's quite a long read, and I apologize for that.
And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks, Don.
This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Del Marva Today, a production of Del Marva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Del Marva Today podcast in iTunes. Del Marva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.